You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. This is part one of a two-part conversation with the editors and contributors of the new book, We Too, Essays on Sex Work and Survival from the Feminist Press. I'm really happy to have the editor of the book with me. Let me tell you about her. Natalie West is a Los Angeles-based writer and educator. She worked as a professional dominatrix while obtaining her PhD in gender studies. She moonlights as a sex work and BDSM authenticity consultant for film and television productions and is currently at work on a memoir. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Natalie.
Thank you, Tristan, so much for having me.
So we're going to kick things off with giving folks a taste of the book, and you're going to read a little from your introduction.
I am. I'm going to read just from the first few pages of the book. And I'll just start it off there. It's 2012. I'm in my mid-20s, struggling to pay my not yet skyrocketing Los Angeles rent. I recently moved from the Midwest, where things weren't really any easier. I'm in graduate school, getting a degree that is unlikely to end in a career that will garner an income high enough to make a dent in the student loans I'm taking out to supplement my meager TA salary. I don't know that yet. Well-meaning people have told me that I will be an exception, and I believe them. I'm the first in my family to have gone to college. My mom and dad are excited that, in a few years, they'll be able to call me doctor. I meet a woman on a dating site who, an hour into our first date, tells me that she's a professional dominatrix. We kiss. I go home and Google dominatrix. I ask my grad school friends if they think I should actually consider dating a dominatrix. They tell me not to be a SWERF. I go home and Google SWERF. It means sex worker exclusive radical feminist. Spring turns to summer and academic work has dried up, as academic work dries up every summer. I date the dominatrix. I can't make rent. I resent my colleagues whose parents send them checks in the mail to cover happy hours, tapas, and new laptops when old laptops break, and research trips to the Beinecke Library at Yale. I get bitter. I start smoking again. Learn to pull a decent shot of espresso and do that for minimum wage. I meet my dominatrix girlfriend's best friend, a middle-aged man who calls himself a fetish photographer, but doesn't appear to work much at all. On his desktop computer, he shows me photographs of blondes in motorcycle jackets and cheesy red press-on nails. They remind me of the girls in hair metal videos my older brother watched on MTV when I was a kid. The fetish photographer used to be in a hair metal band himself. Now he's bald. My dominatrix girlfriend often goes over to his house in the afternoon and doesn't come back until 2 a.m., complaining that she was exhausted, but he wouldn't let her leave. You're the fucking dominatrix, I think, but don't say. You can wear a wig in your sessions, the photographer tells me. There are no good blonde doms in L.A. right now. You'll make a killing. My hair is dark, short, boyish. Men wouldn't pay for it, he says. I've never worked as a dom, and he had supposedly trained half a dozen, so I listened to his advice. He pulls one of his finest blonde wigs down over the wig cap he's placed on my head. I look in the mirror and, surprisingly, I like it. I look like a Texas beauty queen. I take a sip of the Prosecco he's poured me, set it down carefully, and start smoothing down the wig with the palms of my hands. It doesn't shift, but it's hot as hell. I'll teach you everything you need to know, he says. He says it nonchalantly, like I should recognize I'm being done a favor, but the man offering doesn't want too much credit for his generosity. I go alone to the photographer's house to train, the first time I've been alone with him. He's got a large metal dog cage set out waiting. He's wearing nothing but black boxer briefs and his prescription eyeglasses with transition lenses that have stopped working and never adjust to clear, even inside, even at night. He tells me he wants to assist me. He wants to assist me in putting on makeup. I already have makeup on. My girlfriend applied some before I left the house because makeup is not yet a dominatrix skill I've acquired. But I acquiesce. I am training after all. We go to the bathroom and he drops to his knees. He picks up a tray lined with orangey makeup, far too dark for my complexion, and holds it out in front of him. I'm here to serve, mistress, to help you get ready, he whimpers. I grab the foundation. He lowers the tray, pulls down his boxers, and places his hard cock onto it, its distinct curve to the right, making it point directly at a cheap palette of shimmery eyeshadows. You're so helpful, I say, holding back the urge to laugh. I realize at once that professional domination is, indeed, a facet of the service industry. That sex work, as the protest signs say, would be real work. I'm standing in front of the elevator to the fourth floor of a university building that houses the administration offices for the graduate program I've been attending for 4 years with two to go. I usually take the stairs, but I'm already sweating. I rehearse my lines in my head before pushing the button to ascend. He's a jealous ex. No, I don't think he's dangerous. After years of coercion into free play for helping launch my side hustle and professional domination, as well as the career of my much more established dominatrix girlfriend, the fetish photographer snapped, ended our friendship, and went on a mission to end our professional lives. Jilted on a vacation he attended with her and me and two paying clients, imagine feeling entitled to more attention than the guys who were paying for it, he returned from paradise to purchase some domain names. He bought nataliewest.com and redirected it to my grad school student profile, where my legal name appeared alongside a photo of me smiling in front of a bookcase, wearing glasses and the blazer I bought for academic conferences, trying my best to look the part of the young professor. He bought the URL of my legal name and redirected it to my dominatrix website, outing me to anyone who cared to Google my name or work. I knocked timidly at the door of the university administrator's office. Going into as little detail as possible, I tell her I have a jealous ex. I tell her that he's harassing me online and possibly stalking me and definitely trying to ruin my reputation. I tell her that he's taken my photograph. He's taken many photographs. I cry and think that because she's a woman, she's likely to have been stalked too, and so maybe she won't investigate further. I make it past this incident and out of graduate school, earning a degree that they can't take away from me, even if they find the photos of me, even if they find out what I did to feed myself, even well sometimes, and pay my bills while I was there. Reading the outpouring of hashtag MeToo stories on Twitter and across the media landscape in 2017, I immediately thought of the fetish photographer. And then I thought of the kitchen manager at the corporate chain restaurant where I worked during undergrad, who cornered me in a walk-in freezer and forced me to kiss him and feel his erection through his pants. When I filed a complaint, they transferred me to a location 40 minutes away and told me he just wanted to take me out on a date. I thought of the BDSM client who pushed his fingers inside me without my consent. I had experienced sexual harassment and abuse in nearly all the jobs I had done, sex work or otherwise, throughout my working life. I didn't tell any of these stories in 2017, when the hashtag MeToo movement gained traction on social media. I didn't use the hashtag at all. Many of us, workers in various aspects of the sex industries, didn't use the hashtag. There's a great risk in telling stories like mine, like ours. But we too live in a world marked indelibly by sexual harassment and abuse. And as sex workers, who among us hasn't been told that we were asking for it? think I'll stop there. And when we open up into more discussions of the book, we can kind of ask that question and visit it as well.
Yes. Well, thank you for that. I was here sort of shaking my head as I heard it for the second time. But this is a really powerful book. So I want to congratulate you on that. It's unlike any other sex worker book we have out there. And it's a really important one. I think it's got a really diverse group of voices. So there's everything from street-based workers, escorts, porn performers, strippers, massage parlor employees, professional dominants, pro subs, fetish models. It covers a really wide gamut. And as you said there at the end, it begins with the premise that in the wake of #MeToo, sex worker stories were either not included or weren't told at all for a variety of reasons. So tell me how this book came together.
Yeah, absolutely. Its origin really was with the Me Too movement. And I do mean the resurgence of that movement, I think, you know, alongside most other feminists who are doing intersectional work. I do want to acknowledge that movement was started by Tarana Burke in 2006. But in late 2017, it really was a kind of reckoning for me because I was looking at Twitter and I was, you know, I had my thumbs over over my phone thinking about telling some of these stories, and I just kept stopping myself. I wanted to use the hashtag. I wanted to use my voice to talk about the ways that even folks who are doing sex work like pro-doming, which we might imagine is kind of above the fray, right? Like there's these kinds of like whore hierarchies that will say like, oh, well, the professional dominant, like she doesn't experience sexual harassment or abuse, right? Like she's doing something else. And we can talk about that as well. But I was looking at the keyboard and I just couldn't use the hashtag. And I think for me, it came from a lot of different places. It came from, you know, not wanting to be another story that gives, you know, fuel to anti-sex work feminists or fuel to anti-sex worker movements in general to say, you know, like, look at these people. Of course, they're experiencing abuse. We should work to do more work to end what they're doing for a living. And I think, you know, there's a lot of that out there. I think that you know, beyond what we know, which is that the movement itself really excluded a lot of different voices, working class women, and a lot of sex workers are working class sex workers, women of color, right? Trans women. And I think, you know, sex workers definitely among it, but I think sex workers, and you'll see when you read this book, sex workers have a lot of barriers to telling stories of violence because we have had to do so much work to say, we choose this, right? Maybe we choose it because we want to do it, or maybe we choose it because everybody is compelled to labor in order to get money to live. And yeah, it was a really complicated process. And so for me, that's where it started. That's where I kind of started wanting to tell my story. And then it grew exponentially from there because I knew that it wasn't just my story. But it was, you know, a lot of people were experiencing that same hesitancy when they tried to speak out about the violence or abuse that they have experienced at work.
I mean, as you said, it was sort of a lose-lose proposition for sex workers, because if you tell your stories of being victimized and survival, it confirms what sort of mainstream and especially conservatives and anti-sex worker feminists say they already know, which is that sex work is degrading and dangerous. And now this is just more fodder for them, to quote out of context. But if you don't tell the stories, sex workers can't get community support and they can't get resources. They don't have the opportunity to speak their truth, as so many people did online during the resurgence of Me Too. And they don't, in very, very rare cases, have an opportunity to get justice.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, to expand as well, you know, what we think of as abuse, right? And I think this collection does a lot of work to place cops centrally in the kind of realm of violence against women at work. And everybody who's in the collection does not identify as women, but I'm going to use that oftentimes because we just know that the numbers are higher of women and trans women and cis women who are doing sex work. And so I'll probably use that. But when we think about violence against women at work, we don't necessarily think about arrest, but that is a kind of violence that you'll see over and over and over again in this collection, unfortunately, because of the criminal nature of much sex work. And so the book itself, it's not an argument for decrim. And I think, you know, you said at the beginning, this is a collection that feels maybe different from a lot of other sex worker collections. I think that oftentimes, you know, our stories only exist in kind of service of policy change. And certainly we need that. But I think that, you know, what this collection does is it also expands what we think of as violence at work to include the police and interactions with police in that framework.
Okay, we're going to take a break, but boy, do I want to talk about the police. let's just hear from our fabulous sponsors who make this show possible. And when we come back, more with Natalie West. Mm-hmm. 2021 is a time for new beginnings, hopefully. And it's probably time to bring a new attitude to the bedroom. Like a Kitten's Couple Box has everything you need to make this Valentine's Day unforgettable. The box is like a one-stop shop for all your essential, sexy V-Day needs. Don't waste hours getting lube and researching erotic games and then maybe some lingerie and some chocolate and all the things you want to put together for your loved one. Just grab a couple's box and you'll be set up for a spectacular night. I got to try out all the goodies. There's a little piece of lingerie, chocolate CBD body paint, lots of fun, strawberry lube, a 10-speed heart vibe, and a dual arousal cock ring. You know, for my playmate, the games were the most fun. There are these sex scratcher tickets and also a really great card game, which helps you explore different desires and fantasies. I mean, no matter how long you've been together, I'm telling you, we played the game, we had a blast, and we even got to hear new things about each other, which made for some great sex. I want to tell you, this is a great gift box, especially for couples who are ready to, say, get your first sex toys or go deeper in your relationship by sharing fantasies. Also, a portion of all sales go to charities that focus on women's empowerment, education, and health. And I've got a deal for you. Right now, Like a Kitten is offering our listeners 20% off and free shipping when you go to likeakitten.com/Tristan. Or you can enter code Tristan at checkout. Just go to likeakitten.com/Tristan. Or use promo code Tristan to get 20% off your order. likeakitten.com/Tristan. Have a great Valentine's Day, everyone. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. I'm talking today with Natalie West, the editor and creator of the new book, We Too, Essays on Sex Work and Survival. So Natalie, before the break, you brought up law enforcement. And I think it comes up in a lot of people's pieces because, of course, much of the work people do, but not all of it, is criminalized. And I think the general public who has like little education about sex workers would think, okay, so the role of police is they either arrest sex workers or they rescue them and get them out of the life. But it's a lot more complex than that, especially as it relates to abuse and sexual harassment.
Yes, yes. And I think that, you know, with this collection, as you said at the top, you know, we have a lot of workers who are doing a lot of different kinds of sex work in this book. And because of that, you're going to see a lot of different forms of contact with the police, right? Like you have, you know, obviously people who are doing work that is stigmatized, but not criminalized, like folks who are cam models or porn performers. But because the collection really has, you know, has done the work of including voices of folks who, you know, are incarcerated or have been incarcerated on charges related to sex work, you're going to see stories of people who have had direct contact with the police that is at the heart of the violence of the story that they're telling.
And I mean, it's clear that a really high percentage of perpetrators of violence, abuse, and harassment against sex workers are the cops themselves.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are various stories here where you will get the details of police raids, for instance, or sting operations where the cops are, you know, entrapping sex workers into a situation of arrest. And it could be, you know, arrest with the intent to incarcerate, or could be arrest with the intent to save. And, you know, we can kind of touch on that, this sort of idea of like penal welfare, right? That like, that sex workers can be arrested and the criminal courts can be used to provide, for instance, social services in exchange for maybe, you know, a sex worker narking on a pimp or a manager or something like that, right? Like that is oftentimes the ways that you see the police in relationship to sex workers getting a kind of better rap. And I know that, you know, they're trying for that today in an era when we're really thinking about the violence that police are doing. But in this collection, you will see police, doing sting operations. You'll see police entrapping sex workers and causing a lot of harm and violence in their lives, a lot of disruption in their lives.
And there's a whole piece on how that it wasn't illegal, so it was legal for police and informants, also regular people, civilians, to have sex with sex workers in order to make the case stick, or you know, really leave no gray area. Look, she really did trade sex for money. I had sex with her. And that was legal, and is still legal, I think, in parts of the country. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think you're talking about Norma Jean Almodovar's piece, Undercover Agents.
Yeah.
And that piece was written many years ago. I mean, some of the pieces in the collection are also things that we've done reprints on. And Norma Jean specifically is one of our elders in the sex worker rights movement. And so like that piece is really important here, even though some of the law has shifted. And that is important to note. But yeah, the piece, and I think the kind of broader narratives about police entrapping sex workers and having sex with them in order to make the charge stick, even goes so far as that the cop has to come, mm-hmm. right? Or that that some of these are civilian recruits, right, who are coming in to work on the sting, that the act has to come to completion, and completion means that the man has to come in order for the charge to stick, which is something that I think shocks a lot of readers, but doesn't shock a lot of sex workers who have either been victim of these kinds of assaults or have heard it from our community.
So speaking of victim, a theme definitely running throughout this book is the sex worker as victim, in that there's this notion that sex workers can't be victims because they've already, quote, agreed or engaged in this illegal and, quite frankly, what our society deems immoral work. So, and we see this again in court cases that people simply will not afford sex worker victims the same things that they would afford other victims because it's their fault, quote unquote.
Right. And I think that, you know, what What I think becomes really apparent when you read this collection is that sex workers do not sell their consent. There's no like consent wholesale, right? Mm-hmm. When you are working with a client, sex workers have boundaries. They have the right to say, I have given the green light to certain activities and not to others. And so when those other, if their consent is violated, that, just like any other job where, like, let's say, and I'm going to make a comparison to another line of work, because I do think that this helps make the distinction. If you are paid to give massages, and that's what you do, and that is what you have given consent to do, and then somebody propositions you for a happy ending, you're being violated on your, in your workplace, right? Like, that's not what you consented to. You are being harassed or violated in some way. The exact same thing, relevant for sex workers, right? Like, that you can give consent for certain things, and that doesn't mean that whatever happens to you on the job is okay, right? I think that a lot of this comes from, of course, stigma, and it just kind of broader sense, right? That, like, there are some people who are willing to do this work, and thus they are inviolable, right? Like, whatever you do to them, they have already, they're beyond the pale. And I think that, this collection really shows that sex workers are great at establishing boundaries, and that we need the kinds of, the decriminalization could bring about a situation where we would have workplace protections, where we could say, like, no, I am only consenting to X. If you try Y, you are harassing me at my workplace, right? Or you're abusing me in my workplace. And that is something that we do not have now.
Right, right. And there's a subtext to the book that at least I picked up on, which is, it was yet another reminder of how feminism, or I guess mainstream feminism, or white feminism, or neoliberal feminism, still regards sex workers, in that many feminists will not fight for our rights, won't include us in statements. And that just upholds the stigma and creates this hierarchy of what kind of women are part of feminist efforts.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing that I'm really proud of with this collection, is that it's being put out by the feminist press. Mm-hmm. And I think, a press like the feminist press with such a deep and long history of putting forth feminist voices, really standing behind this group of writers, it's a sea change. And I think that it's going to do a lot to really shift those narratives and to say, like, sex workers are at the center of feminist movements, and that we want to move into mainstream feminist movements in the way that they will start fighting on our behalf.
Now, when you roll it all together in one, I mean, some of the authors said, I've always been hesitant to tell this story, or I've never told this story, at least publicly. Did you have any hesitations about putting this material all together out in the world?
I did. Yeah, absolutely. I did. I mean, even that hesitation that I talked about at the very top, right? My own hesitation, like, what is going to happen to my clientele? Like, what is this going to get into the wrong kind of feminist hands? And I think that that's a danger. The first essay in the collection is by Ashley Page, and they say it so well when they're talking about how, there is this kind of balloon, right? That contains all of, the bad shit that happens in any job, right? The bad days, the like slight degradations, the abuses, right? That all workers kind of face. But with sex workers, when you have to sell an image, when you have to sell, power, or you have to sell, seduction, to kind of approach that balloon with a needle and say, like, am I going to pop this? Is it worth it? And I think that the writers who have come together, and certainly for myself, I think, you know, I did this calculus and I think, yes, it is worth it. Especially for sex workers who might not have the kind of intimate community that, you know, you can talk about abuses on the job, right? Like we often hear, and one story that I love is in the foreword by Selena, the stripper, when they're talking about how, you know, there can be like this kinds of like, you know, little pockets of camaraderie when sex workers are able to get together, right? Like if you're dancing together, if you are, you know, if you're organizing together, but there are plenty of sex workers who don't have that kind of community. And I think, you know, if you're just looking at the stories on Twitter, if you're just looking at everybody talk about how like hot and fun everything is, because that's how we get money from clients, you know, you don't have that opportunity to say like, you know what, actually like something really fucked up has happened to me. Mm-hmm. And that's part of my experience. That's not all of my experience, but I want to like share it with other sex workers. And at the end of the day, while I do, you know, want, I don't want it to get into the wrong kinds of hands that will use it against us. I think that we all put this together for other sex workers. That's who this collection's for. And we make that really clear. We're letting other people in on our conversations. And I think that people can learn a lot from that. But at the end of the day, this is for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the book, Sid Nova authored a piece called What Media Coverage of James Dean's Assaults Means for Sex Workers. And there are, in fact, several other chapters by adult performers. And it's striking that one of the most difficult parts of their work in these cases is that violation, coercion, and sexual assault has been filmed and is, in nearly every case, still available for people to consume on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what you think that extra layer adds for folks.
Yeah, I the piece that really stands out for me here is the piece by Hello Rooster, who you know, talks about, you know, the ability for anybody and even themselves to go access you know, the evidence of their abuse. And, you know, I have not performed in porn. And so it's not something that's within my experience, but I think that the folks who are speaking to that here and speaking about the kind of like re-traumatization or even just sort of knowing that it's out there and that other people are consuming images of your assault or your harassment that, you know, that they have no idea what they're consuming. Is really difficult. And I, it sounds, you know, from reading those narratives, I think that they talk a lot about the kind of re-traumatization of knowing that that's out there. And I think that what really comes out of some of these narratives is just, you know, the need for consumers to really do their research, pay for their porn, right? Pay for your porn, do your research, pay for porn from folks you trust, that are doing ethical work. But even, you know, you'll see that there are some essays in the collection that complicate that as well. I'm thinking about Lena Bembe's piece that talks about the sort of, you know, how the ethical or feminist porn set has been turned into a kind of aesthetic, more so than necessarily an ethics. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there's a lot to think about there. And again, you know, like Lena's piece is called Demystifying Porn for Pornographers. And again, these are pieces for people who are in the industry too, to kind of look at their own production, their own practices and you know, start doing the kind of like calling in and changing that needs to happen in order to decrease these instances of violence.
I mean, I certainly, as someone who has been in the feminist porn movement, I do think that there's been a conflation of beautiful aesthetic porn and feminist porn and porn for women. when for me, the focus has always been on labor and the focus has always been on like the process must be feminist. Once I put it out in the world, people can have multiple readings of it. So I can't say what feminist porn looks like, but I can tell you how it's made or how I wish it were made. And I also think those pieces also bring up the notion that no one is immune from what goes on in this world. You know what I mean? No one's immune from misogyny and patriarchy. So even if you are a set where you say our standards are ethical and our standards are feminist, that doesn't mean abuse can't occur. And so that shouldn't be a kind of shield that you're on someone's set who has a certain reputation. And so it's safer than, you know, being on some random guy from Bang Brothers. Please, Bang Brothers, don't send me hate mail.
No, I mean, I think that, you know, you really hit the nail on the head when you said that, which is that, you know, feminist porn or is about process, right? It's a process. It's not a product. And I think that's really, important to remember. And I think, you know, when we think about it as product and we think about like reputation, I think that what these pieces really show is that sometimes reputation can be the shield, right? Like, you know, you have this kind of, you know, like, oh, well, like I know people who have shot with this person, so they must be great. Or like the people who I really look up to or admire in the industry have shot with this person, so they must be safe. And oftentimes that's been really undercut by the experiences that people have with folks who might seem like they're, you know, doing feminist work, in porn or in other areas of the industries. And it turns out that you know, label as a feminist becomes what they can use to victimize people.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to take another break, hear from an advertiser who means the lights are on, at the show. So, it's just going to be a minute or two and then we'll be right back. Are you ready to leave 2020 behind and set new intentions for this year? I am. So whether you're ready to jumpstart a lifestyle change or be more mindful of what you're putting in your body, Saqqara makes it easy. I've really wanted to start eating better, but let me be real here. I don't want to cook. So when Saqqara started sending me prepared meals to try out for this ad, I was all in. Saqqara's organic, ready-to-eat meals are made with powerful plant-based ingredients, and they're designed to boost your energy, improve your digestion, and get your skin glowing. Guess what, folks? They promised it, and it happened for me. The menu of creative, chef-crafted breakfasts, lunches, and dinners changes weekly, so you'll never get bored, and it's delivered fresh anywhere in the U.S. The meals were all terrific. One of the best ones was the Phuket bowl with red pepper lemongrass curry. I threw it all together in a pan for 5 minutes and voila, restaurant quality Thai food just like that. The ingredients are fresh, local to me in Los Angeles, and this curry was super flavorful without being too spicy. Along with delicious plant-rich meals, Saqqara also offers daily wellness essentials, like supplements and herbal teas to support your nutrition. Experience the power of plants as medicine with their best-selling Metabolism Super Powder. Made with organic raw cacao, it works to boost energy, eliminate bloating, minimize sugar cravings, and reduce fatigue. And right now, Saqqara is offering our listeners 20% off their first order when they go to saqqara.com/Tristan, or you can enter promo code Tristan at checkout. That's Saqqara, SAKARA.com/Tristan, to get 20% off your first order. This is a really good deal, folks. I hope you take advantage of it. Saqqara.com/Tristan. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. The book is called We Too, Essays on Sex Work and Survival. It's published by the Feminist Press. It's out now. And I have its editor on the show today, Natalie West. So Natalie, one of my absolute favorite pieces in this book is called We All Deserve to Heal by Yin Q, who's a professional dom in New York City. I want to just quote from the piece. Even when we are not providing the sympathetic ear for personal stories, the work of sex work is active listening. The emotional labor involved is not only being empathetic to the most confidential sexual fantasies, but also then choreographing the enactment is profound and widely unacknowledged, end quote. So this piece sort of has so much nuance and so much depth to it, and it's about sort of so many things all encapsulated in one. But it especially, I think Yin Q especially addresses the labor of it all, which I think is important. I think the average person doesn't always understand.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that particular piece and talking about the ways that sex workers often are asked to carry emotional trauma, carry, you know, stories of abuse, carry a lot from, you know, from our clients. You know, I think that is, again, it's something that people don't think of, even if people are thinking about in a kind of nuanced way about, you know, the things that sex workers experience that can be beautiful, but can also be traumatic, that can be all different ranges of experience. That is one that I thought was really being added to the conversation. And so I'm really thankful for Yin Q for writing the piece. And it's something that I can absolutely relate to. I talk a lot in other aspects of my writing about the ways that as a queer person who is mostly lesbian identified, I didn't know much about men whatsoever until I started doing sex work. And then at that point, I got really intimate with a lot of men and was asked to do a lot of emotional labor for them in terms of fulfilling fantasies, of course, but also holding secrets and it gets heavy. And I think, you know, for myself and also for Tina Horn, who I know you're going to talk to in this kind of second part of this podcast about the book, who I asked to come on as an assistant editor, it was a lot to hold these stories and to hold onto these stories for a couple of years. And you know, now then moving into a place where we're putting them out to the world for other people to read and hold and lighten the load as well. But yeah, our stories, they're heavy, right? Stories from clients are heavy. Stories from other sex workers are heavy. And I'm thankful for having them out in the world and being trusted with them in some ways as well.
You know, they're not just heavy. I think that they are, in fact, universal. So I think people listening to this saying, I don't know that I'm interested in sex work. I don't know anyone who does sex work. By the way, you do. You just don't know. you do. You know someone who has or is currently or will do sex work. But they are universal to me. I think they shouldn't be taken as separate or sort of disregarded in favor of a more, I guess, palatable sexual assault, anti-sexual assault movement. I don't know what that would be. But yeah. I mean, it's clear from these pieces, like, are there specific circumstances for people who trade sexual services for money? Absolutely. But the experiences resonate with many others. There's trauma, there's shame, there's blaming yourself, there's a lack of support or even being believed in the first place. There's no recourse. So in many ways, this is not a sort of niche category. That's not what I got from it.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so either. And you know, I do think that, again, like this coming out of a kind of Me Too moment, like what we were really, the ways that the collection itself was conceived was we're hearing these stories from women who are not in the sex industries, right? From people who are not in the sex industries. We also have these kinds of stories that absolutely overlap in lots of ways. I mean, some of the things that you'll read about here in terms of navigating problems in the workplace are things like the ceiling is leaking in the strip club and like I
like, mm-hmm. you know, slipping and twisting my fucking ankle. Like that is like the, what we're talking about here is work. What we're talking about here is labor. And we are talking about the ways that, you know, that workers have to contend with the folks who are employing them. And I agree with you. I think that there's a lot that is universal here in terms of text, in terms of work, as of separate ideas. And then when you bring them together, of course, that's the intersection in the book.
I mean, I think if we're going to clearly define consent, we can't then say, well, consent is kind of like a little trickier or slipperier for sex workers, right? I've always thought that to be a really strange idea. And I that's why I liked your idea of like showing up to work and being asked to do something. And you're like, no, actually, this is my job. And it's the same thing. Like sex workers are not giving blanket consent to clients ever. And so, so the notion that like consent also can like mean different things in different types of work is really problematic.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that makes, and again, this is not a book that's in, it's not a policy book, right? You're not going to get like straight up, these aren't arguments for decrim, but at the end of the day, when you're working in a criminalized labor market, which is what, you know, many forms of sex work is, there can be no workers' rights, right, in that kind of environment. And so having the, you know, like what we need to do first and foremost is work toward decrim so that the consent of sex workers is being respected, understood. And I think until that happens, it becomes really difficult. And I hope that, you know, when we are navigating these stories, we will have more people who start to fight for the thing that's at the heart of this, which is that you can't stigmatize people, you can't criminalize people, and then expect their consent to not be violated. And as feminists, I think that, you know, that's what we need to be working on is you know, understanding and respecting boundaries and consent. And that's the kind of argument that the stories themselves make.
Yeah, because I mean, in addition to being heavy, I also do want to say that there's also tremendous resilience and even hope in this book to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up because I know that we're talking about a lot of stuff. Yeah, we are talking about a lot of hard stuff, but you know, what else is in this book is a lot of social movement, a lot of protest, a lot of hot sex, a lot of family building, a lot of, you know, just all of the other wonderful things that sex workers do to support ourselves, to heal, to build community. That is all in this book. And I think that that will also be a source of real inspiration for folks who are parts of other movements. You know, I think that there's a lot to draw on here in a lot of different ways. And so it's a heavy book. It's not all heavy. There's a lot of light here too.
Yeah. And just how clear it is that organizing itself around community and in some cases around, you know, like the strippers union and unionizing the strippers, it really is a tool for not just empowerment, better work conditions, but for healing for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like for me as well, I think that, you know, we can look at the movements, the things that we care about and ask ourselves, like, how can I be of use? And, you know, for me, and I know for Tina as well, like this is an activist practice, putting this book out into the world. And you know, it has been healing for me. And I know that I've heard from a lot of the contributors that it has been as well, because again, not telling these stories and then giving the space to say like, you know what, I am going to tell these stories, or I'm going to keep some to myself, because like that can be a brave thing to do as well, right? That this is all part of an activist practice that does have a lot of light at the heart of it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for putting this book out into the world, which also I know as an editor requires a tremendous amount of labor. Some of that labor is also emotional. And thanks for the conversation. I'm so excited that this book is out in the world.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Tristan. This is the first time that I've gotten to do any media for the book, and I'm so excited that it happened here on your podcast. And the book is We Two, Essays on Sex Work and Survival, and it's out from the Feminist Press. Pre-order it, order it, pick up a copy. We are so excited for folks to enjoy these stories with us.
And I especially encourage folks to support their local and independent bookstores. You can also order online to do that at bookshop.org. That is not a paid promotion. That is just a good place where you can support independent booksellers. You can find Natalie on Instagram and Twitter at Ms. Natalie West. And next week, you can hear part two of this discussion. Hear excerpts of the book read by authors Selena the Stripper, Vanessa Carlyle, and Tina Horn. You do not want to miss that. I want to shout out my engineer and editor, A-Rod, at FTC Designs. You can follow him on Twitter at FTC_designs. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. Please run over there and give us a review on your favorite podcast platform. That really helps people find the show. And I am on social media across all platforms at Tristan Terramino. Can't wait for part two. So tune back in.